Okay, so statements of innovation and significance. Out of interest, how many people here have submitted a proposal to the NEH in recent years?
No.
Okay, so not very many of us. Well, when you start the process of writing a grant, and we're going to do this and go over this in much more detail. One of the very first things that you should always do is read the call for proposals and the guidelines. And you'll find on the NEH, particularly from the Office of Digital Humanities, that the very first thing that they request from you is a statement of innovation and significance. And that kind of fills me with terror every time I see it. Because I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I going to say that is going to be really compelling and make them understand how important this is? And I have this moment of terror, and then I think about it, and hopefully, actually, it's not as bad as it sounds. For one thing, they only want 200 words. So
you can figure out how to be pithy in 200 words. Basically, like a Twitter status.
Yes. Yeah. But there are a couple of really good reasons why this is the very first thing that the NEH asks from you. The main reason that I find it helpful is it allows me to really think through the significance of my project. You know, why am I doing this beyond this is interesting to me? Why is it important that I'm doing it? Why is it worth the NEH giving me $25,000 or $300,000 or whatever the budget is for? What is the case that I'm making? So the process of thinking through your statements of innovation and significance, yes, at first glance, it really seems like it's this really annoying hoop that you have to jump through to get your money from NEH. But there are some really important practical reasons why you don't want to do it, and why I generally, one of the very first things that I will do when I'm starting with a project is I will actually write them. I may come back during at the end of the process and revise it based on the proposal and making sure that everything lines up. But actually, the very first thing I do when I'm working on a project is, for my own edification, is write down just very roughly what I believe the most important things about this project are. Why is it that this is a project that is worth doing, and why will it be of interest, not just to me and my stuffy little office, but to a broader public, whether that is academic or the world at large. So, statements of significance, and a lot of the content on these slides is actually drawn directly from the NEH website. So, you know, we're actually using language that you will see. The NEH is really good about telling you what it is that they expect from these statements, and it's always worth looking at it. But so, significance: explain in terms comprehensible to a general audience the significance of your proposed project. What that means is that you need to make sure that Joe Bloggs, who you meet in the elevator for 30 seconds, can understand what it is that you're trying to do. It's all very well writing a proposal about topic modeling and littering it with LDA, mallets, all of these terms that are meaningful to you, but in the context of the 250 words that you have to write this thing, you have no time or space to elucidate what that actually means. So you have to think very carefully through what you write to make sure that it is as meaningful to me as it is to my mother. And that's generally how I think about it, right? If I can explain it to my mother and she won't have questions, I've succeeded. And the idea is, for this statements of significance. This is really focused on how does your project contribute to the particular discipline or field that you're engaging with. So it might be that you are interested in the Mining Your Dispatch, Mining the Richmond Dispatch project, for example. You were talking there about how it's relevant to Civil War studies. What are the particular questions that you are engaging with within the broader historiography or the broader arguments of your field? This is the disciplinary section of it. This is where you get to show off a little bit about what you know about your specific area of expertise. You want to say very briefly what the impact of your research is, and this is going to be a statement along the lines of, as a result of this project, we're going to know more about the history of the Civil War in Richmond, Virginia. Now, it's very broad statements, sure, because you only have a short amount of space in which to do it. But this is where you get to make the grand claims, the big statements about what your project is going to be. How is it evaluated? It has to be relevant. It has to fit in with the existing. Within the existing boundaries of the field. So they're not necessarily going to have someone on that review panel who is an expert in your specific discipline, but they are likely to have someone in there who is broadly aware of it. So you need to be able to talk about the intellectual significance of it. You need to be able to talk about how it might enhance research or teaching or learning. You need to be able to talk a little bit, perhaps, about what the audience for this for your project is going to be. So, as an example, what I want to kind of do is work through this just a little bit and see what we think about it as an example of a statement of significance. So this is actually a real world one. I will spoil it and say that this project was funded. But our workshop will provide humanities scholars with a deeper understanding of the vocabulary of LDA topic modeling and other latent variable modeling methods and best practices for interpreting the output of such analysis, and will articulate fundamental literacy and historical questions for researchers outside of the humanities who are developing the models and methods as well as the software implementations. So beyond being a bit of a mouthful, what are your reactions to that? And I'll warn you, Jen wrote it, so.
Feel free to critique.
Yeah.
It's very jargon heavy for me, very much. Latent variable modeling methods. I understand all the individual words. It doesn't mean anything to me. LDA topic modeling doesn't mean anything to me. So I just find it very hard to actually understand what it's doing.
Right.
Hence, we included an appendices that defines all of the words.
Fair enough. But given that Simon is deliberately passing you up here.
Yeah.
So. And by the way, this is an exemplar on the NEH site of a good grant. So that tells you how weird the characteristics are and what constitutes a good grant.
Yeah.
But aside from those two terms, LDA topic modeling and the latent variable modeling methods, everything else I understand. And I would assume that those are things that I actually shouldn't understand yet, otherwise you wouldn't need to offer this particular workshop.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think one of the best things about this is the first sentence says, this is what we'll do for humanities scholars, and then later on, this is what we'll do for researchers outside of the humanities. So it's like, yes, we're targeting humanities scholars because you're NEH, but everyone can adapt to this and use it across the disciplines, and it's hard
to
everyone.
This is the public mandate issue. So NEH and all federal funders have a public mandate that's been set for them by U.S. Congress. And NEH's is that it must serve the humanities, but it must also serve the general public. The National Science Foundation could give two craps about the general public. And if you try and write about the general public, they're going to lock you out of the room. every funder that you apply to has a different mandate. So the first time you write for a funder, look at their mission statement and look at their mandate.
Any other thoughts about this? Yeah.
It's broad. It's specific or broad. But it also has those keywords to say it's going to be, it's going to provide some sort of like turning point. It's going to be fundamental, a deeper understanding, best practices. So it's saying we're raising the bar and we're shooting for the best.
It kind of makes me think of like a learning outcomes analysis statement.
Yep.
So like this is what the student will be able to do at the end of the workshop.
Yeah.
And this is the difference between a workshop-based sort of, you know, statement and like a statement that's about a project. Like on a workshop-based, they're looking for what the learning outcome really is. Like, what is the takeaway? On a project, the takeaway that you write about could be the product itself. Like, this will result in a software or result in a website or result in something. But in a learning-based statement, you want to make sure that you sort of hit those phrases and vocabulary that you see in what you teach to students.
So for my takeaway from this, you know, there are several things that I think work really well with this statement of significance. The first is the phrase deeper understanding, because deeper understanding, it immediately sets up that this is not going to be an introductory workshop, that you're going to have to. It's creating immediately the expectations within the reviewer's mind. And bearing in mind, this is the very first thing a reviewer will read. The statements of innovation and significance. It's the first page of your grant. It's literally the first thing that they read. So this is where you are setting their expectations as to what it is that you are going to be doing. So a deeper understanding of the vocabulary of LDA topic modeling. Yeah, LDA is a bit jargonish, perhaps if you are a complete layperson. But topic modeling is a relatively well-known subject within the field of digital humanities that you would certainly hope a reviewer on an NEH panel is going to be at least familiar with. So you've immediately set up the criteria that this is going to be not an introductory workshop, but it's going to be an opportunity for new insights to be found into the topic of LDA topic modeling. It then suggests that it's going to be an agenda-setting workshop with the phrase best practices, and articulate fundamental literacy and literary and historical questions. So again, it's reinforcing that this is going to be an important agenda-setting topic that's going to have broad applicability. The only thing I don't like about this is it's all one sentence.
Yep. I have a run-on sentence issue. Yes, very much so.
But otherwise, you know, this, you know, as NEH obviously feels, if I didn't know it was posted as an exemplar. For a workshop proposal, you could do far worse than borrow the overall structure of this statement of significance in terms of establishing who the audience is in the first part of it, and then saying what the agenda setting function is going to be. And this was actually the November workshop that you guys did. So you know, it pretty much describes what the intent was. So that's statements of significance. The other part of it, which is actually a lot harder, is the statements of innovation. And you know, to define innovation, there are all sorts of things that you can fit under this. Obviously, the hope is that you're going to be creating something new. But within that can cast a very large net as to how you define new. In the case of a workshop, it's new. It's a new agenda. It's a new way of thinking about the subject of topic modeling, but it can also include an interesting or new approach to tackling the problem. So everyone's doing topic modeling. Maybe you have this idea for how topic modeling could be improved. You know, it could be an exploratory research project that would look into ways in which we can improve the process by which humanities scholars engage in topic modeling problems. It could be a technical innovation. So it could be that you are interested in developing a new way of interacting with topic modeling software. One of the main issues with topic modeling right now, and I'm going to stop talking about topic modeling soon, I promise, is that you have to know how to use the command line. You have to basically be able to program. There isn't a user-friendly way of interacting with the software. So your technical innovation might be to develop a front end for an existing system that scholars are already using, but that is not very easy. So you're broadening the participation in the humanities for that particular topic. Makes use of an existing technology in a new way. You might be interested in displaying an archive. One of the things that you will learn is that National Endowment for the Humanities does not support digitization projects per se. What they do support are interesting ways of presenting new knowledge. So you're not going to get a lot of money from them for saying that you have this collection of documents and you want to scan them and put them on the internet. That's pretty much a non-starter at this point as far as the NEH is concerned. But what you might be able to do would be to think about ways in which you can improve the process of improving the workflow that leads to the production of a digital archive. It might be new ways of integrating existing technologies, so adding a GIS spatial layer to an archive in a way that hasn't already been done. These are all very, very broad terms, but you have to think about ways in which you can frame your project as being something that others have not done, or at least have not done successfully. Otherwise, they are going to be very hard for you to frame in terms of at least getting funding. Now, internally, when you're in your university, if you're engaged in a digitization project, they have very different levels of expectation. Those are things that you might be able to get funded and that you wouldn't otherwise be able to from someone like the National Endowment for the Humanities. But you still need to think about, why is this exciting? Why is this worth the investment of X thousand dollars, X million dollars, if the project is going to scale? And what gets people excited is, in the words of my advisor, the potential of being on the front page of the Chronicle. I hear that pretty much every other week from him, that we need to do projects that will get us on the front page of the Chronicle, that will get people excited. And they aren't necessarily... that's obviously a very high bar that you are setting for yourself with that, but it's a good way of thinking about it, I think. That you want to do things that people will be excited about, and that by definition means that it has to be at some level new. So this is a quote from the National Endowment for the Humanities website for their guidelines. True innovation is rare. Reasonable people can disagree as to what constitutes innovation. You therefore need to make a strong case for the innovative character of the proposed project. So, realistically, what you're going to be what you're going to be proposing at some level is going to be building on other people's work. It's unlikely that you're going to have a project that is going to be truly groundbreaking and completely isolated from everything else that has gone before. So you need to think about ways in which you can frame your project to highlight what it is that is innovative, what it is that is exciting about it. This is another example. This is another one of Jen's, I think, that was funded.
Yes.
So this is a bit longer. The statement of innovation has a slightly longer word length for it. I'm not going to read it out to you. But do read it, because we're going to critique it again.
I really should have chosen someone else's examples. What you'll find is the more you do projects, the more you critique your own work and want critique of your own work, because you tend to use the same formulas and language across projects. So, critique away.
Critique so much as a comment on what I think is actually a really bright strategic decision, which was the use of potential.
Yep. That's so that if the project fails, which is failure is acceptable, and we'll talk about that, so that if the project fails, you're covered.
Yeah.
And then you can say, we learned these things, and so next time someone tries it, they should do something different. So it's still applicable.
Sounds like a science project for the humanities, right? It puts the human back in the project.
Yep.
Yep.
It also works with a fairly easy structure to manage, which is, here's the way things are, here's what would be a better way, here's how we're going to try to get there.
Yep.
In those three sentences.
And it's also like, you can crowdsource, but one person cannot take the place of your crowdsourcing.
So one of the things that's important about this one in particular is crowdsourcing is a big thing in digital humanities. You know, the notion of putting all of your stuff online and having other people be your labor. And I don't disagree that crowdsourcing is a good idea. It is a good idea for some projects. But it's not something that works well for this. It relies on a lot of different factors that can't be controlled. So when I wrote this, I thought about the fact that I was likely to have reviewers that are big fans of crowdsourcing. And we're going to be super upset if I started with crowdsourcing doesn't work worth a crap, or you know this completely fails. In other words, thinking about measured rhetoric is very important when you're writing for a reviewer-based audience, because you never know who your reviewers will be. So trying to avoid controversial positions or terms, or even when you're calling out projects, and we'll talk about this in a later lesson, there's a way to do it, to say, they're doing such a great job,
but.
But that's an important strategy to have, particularly when you're taking on issues or topics or contentious contexts and materials that you sort of lay out. It's doing a great job, but here's what's missing, and here's why my project is better than what you could hope for.
I mean, it's no different to blind review of articles or books. Right? You need to think about how what you're going to say might annoy the other expert, that if NEH have done their research and want to do a truly critical review of a project, they're going to find the other world expert on this. And if he happens to disagree with you and you frame it in a way that upsets him or her, then you're in a lot of trouble, because although it's, there are typically four or five reviewers on these things, I've had projects that have gone into the review process with really great reviews from four out of the five, and that one person who didn't like it has gone in and he has torn it apart and dropped the average review by 2 or 3 points, and it's been rejected. So the idea of the idea of framing it in a way that highlights what it is what the gaps are that you are trying to fill, what the existing technical limitations that you see are, but doing it in such a way that you are building on the knowledge and building on these tools rather than tearing the existing ones apart to replace it with your own, with your own version of it. Any other thoughts on statement of significance? Yeah.
This might be jumping ahead slightly, but you do an environmental scan usually in most grant proposals. Which obviously directly plays into your statement of innovations. You're going to be referring to the things you're building on. So maybe you would do this in the environmental scan section of this class, but what is the best way to kind of like nod to those specific programs you're building on with only 200 characters? You know, you can't say it in both places, but you don't want too many.
If you notice here, there are no specifics about existing projects, existing issues, existing whatever, beyond this sort of like miniature story that's told in the first sentence. What you hope for is that you get a good reviewer panel and they actually read the entirety of your grant. That's what you hope for. That's what they're supposed to do. That's what they're required to do. Whether they do that or not is an individual reviewer's call. So I tend to avoid, in my statement of innovation or significance, putting in any pointers to existing projects. And there's a reason, a really specific reason why, which is this is what goes public to from NEH to others if they are looking for your projects. Or if they're putting this in front of their review board, the chairman's board that votes on you getting money, this is most likely what they're going to see, the statement of humanity significance and the statement of innovation. Very rarely, if ever, have I heard of the review board at the chairman's level actually reading the entirety of a grant ever. Usually what they get is a packet that is just this information. So these are politicians, guys. These are Uber administrators on steroids. They're not going to look up the project citation. They're not going to want to care about whatever. If you get lucky, you get ones that are humanists that are paying attention. But oftentimes, these are guys who, like, you know, run Fortune 500 companies and businesses who get the final vote after it comes out of the review committees. And we're going to talk about that review process because no matter which country you're in, all of them have some sort of review process where your stuff has to be vetted.
Yeah, so, I mean, the trick here is, you know, you're talking to, again, it's you're talking to a general audience. And you're talking generally about what the significance of your project is. So there are places within the narrative itself for the broader discussions of how it is going to build upon specific examples of work, how it's going to, going back to the statement of innovation and the notion of how it fits in within the discipline. You know, there are statements, there are portions within the narrative where you are expected to talk about the historiography or the types of literary analysis that you are building upon or that you are challenging, or more broadly what the humanities problem is that you are engaging with. So these are as Jen says, this is the snapshot that gets published on the website. This is your elevator speech where you're standing in the elevator in your hotel and someone asks you what you do for a living and you have 30 seconds to describe it. That's a great way of thinking about these statements. You're trying to get as much information across in as short a period of time as possible. So they're very competing requirements. They're very contradictory requirements. But it's a really great way of distilling down what it is that you're trying to do and getting it clear in your own head. And these are also great things to give out to your collaborators, to your administrators, to the various stakeholders that we'll be talking about in a couple of days' time, who have a vested interest in your project for one reason or another, but who aren't directly involved. And these are things that they can themselves regurgitate and discuss. So you want them to be focused and clear for that reason as much as anything else, because they're not, there's going to be confusion, there's going to be questions asked about why you're doing it and potentially other issues. So the other aspect about thinking about these statements of innovation and significance is, what are your objectives? You know, what is it that you're going to try and get out of this? What are the deliverables going to be? There are a couple of ways of thinking about it. It's in terms of the amount of data that you're going to be using, the number of pages on a website that you might be creating, the number of things that you're doing. You need to think through very clearly about what are the major goals of this project. You know, Jen in the example just now was talks about using the word potentially to help manage expectations for the project. Some of your goals might be much more substantive, just depending on what the individual project is. But they might be things like developing a data repository that will be launched in the third quarter of the second year of this project. They're very concrete things that explain what it is that you are trying to do in a very clear way. So the best way of doing it, of course, is with bullet points or itemized lists. The objective of this project is to learn what is unique about the style of individual artists and to provide results at a much higher level of confidence than previously has been feasible. So that gives, in this example, it gives a very broad overview of what the goals are. And then it breaks those points down a bit further. So it takes the different points that are made in the sentence and elucidates them so that there is that bit more detail and will help the participants, the readers, will help you understand what it is that you're trying to do. And these goals then track into your milestones. They then track into your deliverables, and ultimately they track into your final product. So again, this is a process where I will write this down very early on in the project, and then I use it as a checklist for making sure that I've discussed all of these goals in the context of the proposal that I've written, and made sure that everything matches across, that I haven't introduced new goals, or I haven't included in my budget time for a programmer to do step B, because you know that would be a problem. And this really acts as a way of helping you keep track of what it is that you're trying to do, what it is that you are promising that you're going to do, and gives reviewers the same overview, the same level of detail that they can refer back to and make sure that you have discussed all of the goals and that you have created relevant action plans and what have you.
This is also what you hold your project team to.
Yes.
So we're going to talk about, you know, how projects can grow and become unwieldy and spread out of control. Ultimately, this statement, this objective statement, is what guides the decision-making process you're going to make throughout the life cycle of your project. You know, these objectives are the one that really set the rules for how things are going to work for your project. And we're going to talk a little bit about tomorrow, sort of what happens when your objectives may change or you need to change them because resources change and things like that. But one of the things I want to highlight about this statement, and we definitely should critique this statement, this is, I guess, 6 years old now, and there's definitely things I would do differently, is you'll notice this was a grant that was going into the National Science Foundation. What is the difference between this statement and the statement you saw previously in terms of either the significance or the innovation?
Language is statistical and mathematical. It is not about greater understanding or whatever. It's about higher levels of confidence.
So this is very mathematically, computationally based language. What else is different about this sort of language versus the language you saw in the previous two statements?
We have finite numbers.
Right.
Not as much as a narrative. So you.
Yeah, there's not a grand vision, you know, saving the world sort of broad story statement.
That's not really allowing for possibility.
Yeah.
You're not gonna fail, you're gonna do this.
Yeah. This is in part because this is the National Science Foundation. These are like the game players. You know, these are the people that are super serious about it. Every review panel member is going to be a PhD specializing in particular things. You're not going to get a librarian reviewing this. And no digs on librarians, they're just as qualified as anybody else. But you're going to get reviewers that are PhDs in computer science and mathematics and things like that. So this is language that they would be comfortable with. The problem I have with this statement, just as a issue, and we'll talk about this in the workshop portion that's coming next. It is way too wordy. There's too many modifiers in this statement for me. Like, what is unique about the style of individual artists? Okay? I could shorten this down. I could make it even more pithy. It needed another edit to take out some of the extra language that's sort of drawing it out. Even things like, as such we will. Like, linguistically it works, but it's actually four wasted words. I could have just said, the objective of this project, feasible, colon, we will, colon, move on. In other words, thinking about efficiency and expediency. The thing that I want to highlight with humanity statements, statement of innovation, and objectives, how long is your attention span when you read? Because most people have very short attention spans when they read, and you want to think about the fact that most people are going to stop every paragraph, two paragraphs, or three paragraphs to have a drink of water, to check their email, to tweet something, to whatever. So the more concise you can be, and the more polite you are about keeping it all nice and tidy, the likelier it will be that your reviewer or your even your project team will read all the way through it. Yeah.
One of the things I always find out, I do, and so I warn people about this, is that when you do that sort of introductory paragraph, and people just read the first few words and don't read the rest of it, and just look at the little lines. So I think one of the things is you have to really have right away what you're going to do, what you're going to delineate. But then do you recommend... I'm always uncertain which order to put these things in. You recommend this is in the order of what happens.
Right.
Is that what your recommendation is?
In a work plan, yes. In a work plan, it should always be in the order in which it will take place. In fact, in this, the reason why it's in this order is this is a project where we had three different data sets and three different universities that were working on the project, and each university had its own computational approach and its own computational data set that it was working in. So the reason why it is this way is that dealing with all of the collections together comprehensively was the thing we were least interested in. We wanted to get to fixing the algorithms. This was a project team of 17, and two-thirds of them were computer scientists who built image analysis algorithms. So what we really wanted was better algorithms. And so we put that first, because that's the thing we got to get to and get it fixed, because it's not working. We cared less about, you know, I mean, accuracy and everything was good, but we couldn't really do it for everything what we wanted. So one school had an accuracy rating of like 83%, but they were using a data set of like 1.2 gigs. Whereas another school had an accuracy of 10, they were using 10 gigs and then an accuracy rating of like 13%. You know, we really should be able to fix that and had hoped with more funding we would be able to fix that. But it was something that for us was less important than making better algorithms to start off with.
Yeah, the way to think about it, again, it goes down to how the attention spans of the reviewer, the people reading this, you want to get your main points first because it's more likely to be read. And your main point is likely to be your sexy point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your hook, and it's what's going to get them to read through to the last point. So really, if you look at this, you know, the structure of this, as Jen says, this is the sexy part. You know, this is the bit where you're going in and you're designing the algorithm and doing all of this. The second point is, from the humanities perspective, this might be the sexy point.
Actually being able to test it.
Test it against real-life data, real humanities data, but given that this went to the NSF, this is kind of the proof of concept part, which is important, but it's not as important as the algorithm. And then this third part is the reporting part, and this is the dissemination, this is the documentation part, which is not sexy at all, but is important. So what you're doing is you're showing the reviewer that you've thought through the process as much as anything else, that you're going to be designing, you're going to want to test, but you also acknowledge that it's as important to tell people about it and to report what you've done.
Right, so this was a grant that went into, for the Digging Into Data Challenge competition. Digging Into Data, it was the first multinational digital humanities grant competition that was ever run. We submitted this in 2008. This is the segment that went into NSF. We wrote exactly the same language in a mirror segment for the humanities. It's the exact same project, and it sounds completely different. because the humanities language that was in was about the manuscript collections and the quilt index that we use and like all the foofy art that got included. And we talked about how important these artists were and how important these quilters were. And we sort of like slipped in there that there would be this image analysis work going on with the NSF money. And we sort of moved on. Like that grant, their side of the grant was all about sort of the interpreted meaning aspects, not about the computational science-y aspects. And that's something that you need to think about and that we'll talk about this week is that when you write a grant, you don't have to write one grant for one funder and never write again for another. You can write one grant and partition it into pieces to different funders simultaneously. As long as the work does not overlap, you can still use the same body of materials and the same resources to different funders at the same time.
You can even do it to the same funder, but different divisions.
Different divisions.
I do that with NSF all the time. And as Jen says, as long as they are clearly delineated different, you know, as long as the projects are clearly delineated, that's absolutely fine. And you can think about it in terms of it might be the same project with different aspects of it, or it might be the same project with different data asking different questions.
So questions about that whole multidisciplinary division, we'll talk about that a little
bit. So I was just going to say, so basically, back to Irene's questions, you sort of want to prioritize your bullets on your outcomes, not necessarily so your sexiest outcome or what you really want to get. If you never get to anything else, that goes first, and then you sort of work through.
Right. In part because, and this is something very few people realize, is that funders have the option not to give you the full amount that you have requested. They can give you less money than you have requested. NEH does this all the time with their digital editions projects and things like that. So what we do when we start building a budget, and you'll learn this week when we go through the building a budget, is we ascribe dollar amounts to each of these objectives and put them in stages. And we basically then say, if we get $68,000, we can do number one. If we get $125,000, we can do one and two. If we get $250,000, which is what we really wanted, we can do one, two, and three. And we'll talk about how you think about that construction and how you figure out those numbers. But the thing to always remember when you sort of think about humanity, significance, innovation, and objective is that the average person reading it is going to be reading 20 to 25 of these in a panel review. Oftentimes, panel reviews happen in September, November, and January. I don't know what September and January are like at your university, but our faculty are usually a bit frazzled and stressed, and you're coming off of Christmas. So you want to think about the fact that, you know, be as clear as possible, bullet points. You know, footnotes are great to hide material that may be unsexy or uninteresting. Yeah. Do it all the time.
What Jen is saying is that if you're lucky, the reviewer is reading it on the plane on the way to DC. If you're lucky. If you're not lucky, he's reading it in the hotel the night before.
Right.
Or in the room.
Right.
So, you know, you have to think about... It's an art form in itself to think about how people are reviewing these and how best to present it and make it palatable to them.
And to go back to Denise's question from this morning about, like, you know, how do you negotiate all of this stuff or when should you negotiate stuff? Writing a grant or writing these types of statements is the perfect moment to negotiate with your team members about what our priorities are, what our objectives should be. Because if everybody agrees and signs off on this kind of stuff, nobody can backtrack later and say, well, I didn't know that was item number 13 on the list, and we can only get through 11. And we'll talk about sort of that strategy of managing those objectives and thought processes.